For the week of January 5th, 2020, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 475, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz. Happy New Year, Sperling. You seem very excited by 2020.
I am very excited. I just wanted to make sure I didn't say 2019, unlike all of the checks I'm writing and the diary entries I make where I say, you know, January 4th, 2019, and then I have to cross out and write 2020. Yeah, I'm still getting used to the whole fact that there is no longer a one in any of the years.
Well, hopefully you'll be able to see clearly for the rest of 2020.
I don't understand what that has to be a reference to something.
2020.
Oh, 2020.
There you
yeah,
go.
Eyesight. Yeah, I got it. Hey, that's pretty good, actually. That's
all
pretty
right.
Good. Well, I can't understand corny jokes. I can only tell them.
Now, what are we going to talk about this week? It's a new year. It's a new box office. It's new entertainment stuff, but the same old stuff is happening, isn't it? People are making money. Deals are being made. Mergers are happening, etc.
Awards are being given out.
Awards are being given out.
Yes, indeed. Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're getting more data, as you mentioned, Michael, on the entertainment business and how it did in 2019. So we are going to kind of take a quick look back. We've got record-breaking numbers from France, totals for China, and if Disney were its own country, get this, it would be the single biggest market in the world, okay? Plus, MGM has a new head. Hopefully, it's going to be put in one of those little, you know, circles with the lion, you know. Anyway, the awards season is heating up. We've got the latest nominations from the Cinematographers Guild and the winners according to the National Society of Film Critics. Korea is going to be very happy. Oh, and there was this whole Golden Globe thing last night, which I guess we'll touch on. On Inside Baseball, we'll focus on theater, you know, the Broadway kind. Depending on how you slice the numbers, they had the second biggest or the biggest year in Broadway history. Either way, they sold a lot of tickets. We'll give you the scoop and then look ahead at the spring season by putting Michael on the spot.
What?
And asking if he would invest or not invest in any of these new big shows.
Plus, Australia is on fire and we're going to war. But well, that's for another podcast.
Well, now that you mentioned it, of course, you know, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. Oh, wait. Actually, none of those things will be in Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we're going to turn it over to you, Michael, entertainment journalist extraordinaire, to fill us in on last week's box office.
That's right. And we're looking at box office around the world. It's one of the biggest weeks of the year, of course. The holidays, Christmas, New Year's. People go to a lot of movies, so there's a lot of films to talk about. At number one around the world, we link to ComScore in our show notes. We pull information from Variety and Chinese box office charts, India box office charts, and we've got the figures for you. Nobody else does. The number one movie around the world is Star Wars: The Rise of Skywalker. $193 million last week. It's at $918 million worldwide. Some say they have their sights set on a billion. They don't have their sights set on it. They are going to easily pass $1 billion.
Or as Marvel would say, only a billion.
At number two around the world is Jumanji, The Next Level. Another $139 million. That's at $610 million and counting. And at number three is Frozen 2, the Disney animated flick. $108 million last week. Clearly, the dearth of successful new family films really opened up a lane for Frozen 2. It's at now $1,325,000,000. Disney proudly announced it is the highest grossing animated film of all time, ignoring their own film, The Lion King, which came out this year and made more money.
Well, and some would say is not animated because it's live action.
It's not live action. It's animated. It looks live action, but lots of animated films try to look live action. The Lion King is an animated film. It will be eligible for Best Picture, but it will be eligible for Best Animated Film, period.
And it was nominated for Best Animated Film at
because
the Golden
Globes. Animated.
Right. But, you know, look, both of those are technically sequels. I don't think, like with Frozen 2, they're not like venturing into the unknown with these movies.
Well, the first one was an original film based on nothing. Right. It was an original content. So, you know, fair enough. However,
But you know, when I make my music puns, it wasn't Into the Unknown, the song that...
Oh, sorry, I haven't seen the film yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, okay then.
Yeah, so that went right over my head. But again, here's a great example of why we look at the worldwide box office, which more and more people are starting to do, at least a little bit on the side. You could say, oh, Star Wars made $84 million last week.
Okay.
Or you could say they made $193 million. Why would you ignore $109 million of box office? You could say that Jumanji made $68 million. Or you could say Jumanji made $139 million. Again, why are you ignoring all this box office? It looks better. It's better for the business. It's better for the movies. It's better overall. It gets people more excited. No reason to ignore money just because it's made Monday through Thursday. And here's a movie that did open up on like Monday or Tuesday. It's a Chinese romantic drama called Adoring. From the trailer, I couldn't figure out what was going on, except there were lots of pretty young people and they all love their pets. And apparently that's exactly what it's about. It's about pet lovers. I guess they fall in love too, but who knows? It grossed $62 million on its opening week. And number five is Spies in Disguise, the blue sky flick pulled up by Disney. That grossed $50 million this week. It's at $88 million and counting. So that is a film providing a little competition for Frozen 2. It is reaching the kiddies and doing okay just by them.
Well, think about it. The last 2 weeks, parents needed something to do with their kids.
That's right. And number six is Little Women. That made another $45 million. That's at $80 million and counting. That has a long road ahead of it, so it's going to do just fine. Just like Knives Out, an original film geared for adults. It made $33 million this week. It's at $250 million worldwide. Brace yourself, Sperling. You may not be expecting this. They're making a sequel.
What?
Yes, well, I can't believe
actually,
it.
Actually, it's funny that you should say that because I have seen this film. Now, have you seen Knives Out?
I have indeed.
Okay, because as I was watching it, I was like, where have I seen this before? Oh, yeah, every Agatha Christie movie or every Agatha Christie book. It felt like an Agatha Christie story.
That was the attempt. That was the desire. Okay. And like Agatha Christie, they tackle social issues. Agatha Christie did that a little bit on the sly, and here Knives Out clearly tackles inequality.
Well, right. And, you know, although it doesn't put it, you know, up front, but
yeah,
it does. it kind of touches on it.
No, it doesn't touch on it. The entire film is about it.
Well,
no,
okay.
The whole family and the maid and the.
Oh, yeah, that's true. No, I guess when you put it that way.
Yeah, but we look at the plot.
But that said, I was like, oh my God, it dawned on me like a day or two later. I thought, did Daniel Craig just launch another franchise? Because he could actually show up as the detective in another movie.
Well, he can and he will. And I pray he uses an entirely different, ridiculous accent. I hope next time he speaks with the French accent because his southern accent is so bat crazy. You're going to have to bleep me there. But I took it as part of the joke of the film that he was doing this absurdly bad southern accent and it's never explained. So next time I hope he does like Clouseau. Anyway, at number eight around the world is Tolo Tolo, an Italian comedy. It grossed $31 million this week. I know I looked it up. What is Tolo? Oh, yes. It's a, where are you, kid? I'm sure I looked it up. What's Tolo Tolo about? I can't remember. Oh, well.
It's about something. It's about words that you repeat more than once.
That's right. It made a lot of money. That's what I know. $31 million on its opening week. Right below that is the Hindi comedy Good News. Another $23 million for that sperm swap comedy. It's made a total of $31 million and counting. I hope your kids are in bed.
You mean
that, or, I said sperm swap. You have to explain it all. You don't want to be bothered. And number
although
10,
ironically, mm-hmm. You saw Knives Out.
Yes.
When I saw it, I was sitting next to a mother who had her two under 10.
Well, there's nothing in the film that's shocking or unpleasant.
No, but some of the language.
All right. At number 10 is Ip Man 4, the finale. $20 million it made this week. It's at $131 million worldwide. Right below that is Ash Fall, the Korean disaster flick, $19 million. That's at just under $50 million. Cats is just above $50 million. It made about $19 million this week. It's at $57 million worldwide. We hate to prejudge a film. You never know how it's going to do overseas. You never know where it might click. Bad buzz in the U.S. doesn't always translate. This movie seems to be doing poorly everywhere.
Well, and it doesn't help that Ricky Gervais, basically used it as a punching bag last night during the Golden Globes. In fact, Universal should be charging money for every joke he told about Cats. They might actually make some money that way.
The Grudge is a horror flick that opened up in North America. It opened pretty poorly, but it's made $17 million so far, and it only cost $10 million to make. So even when you screw up, if you keep the budget low enough and have a big enough ad campaign, you can be okay. Certainly Uncut Gems has a great ad campaign. Has Obama seen it yet? $16 million it made this week. It's at $36 million worldwide. Now, here's a
now I know why you're saying that, because last week
our beloved listeners listen to our show every single week.
But that said, that wasn't where I was headed with this. Did you see Phoebe Waller-Bridge last night?
I didn't watch the show.
So last night on the Golden Globes, she actually thanked Obama for watching the show and putting it on his year-end list.
Well, because she has a joke about him in it.
Yeah. Well, yes, exactly.
That's why it's funny. Otherwise, it wouldn't be funny.
All right.
All right. Here's another mystery for you. Servant. It grossed $13 million this week. I have no idea what country it debuted in, what it's about, what it is, what language they speak in. I have no idea. If you know, contact us.
Yes, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. We're also on Twitter. We're @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox.
Bombshell made about $9 million this week. It's at number 16. It's at $25 million and counting. It needs some Oscar love to keep going at the box office, I think. After this week, it could start to fall a little quickly. At number 17 is another new film. It's Begin Again, a Chinese film. It made $8 million on its opening week. Just like the next three films, there is Invasion, a.k.a. Attraction 2, a Russian sci-fi flick. There is My Mom is a Character, Part 3. That's the Brazilian comedy. That's now at $14 million total. And Sheep Without a Shepherd, a Chinese crime drama, that made another $8 million. That's at $135 million and counting. Right below them is a new film. It's The Gentleman, directed by Guy Ritchie. Another crime flick in the UK for him. It opened to $7 million. It does star a couple people. It's Matthew McConaughey, Charlie Hunnam, Colin Farrell, and Hugh Grant. Nobody's quite the badass like Colin Farrell.
Hey, by the way, Sheep Without a Shepherd, you know it's a remake, right?
Of the Indian film. That's the remake of the Indian film. What's it called? Drashnya or something like that?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. We should have pointed that out the first time the movie came up in China. Yes, no, and the funny thing about that is that I don't want to say Bollywood, I'm not sure about that. So it's the Indian film is a scathing comment on corruption and inequality and the police. The Chinese version is the exact same film, except it radically changes the ending because they don't like you questioning the government. So they completely undercut the whole point of the film with the ending there. So if you're in China or have seen both versions, comment further, because we're just speaking about what we've read online. So that's fascinating, I think. The government says, no, you're not going to do that.
Yeah, and the only reason that we're only commenting on what we've read online is because we can't see any of these movies.
That's not true. That is not true at all. Both of them may be playing or have played in North America, so I wouldn't say that in the least. We see lots of Indian films and increasingly a number of Chinese films playing in the U.S., so that's not true. And I don't think Sheep Without a Shepherd has opened up yet in the U.S.,
That's what I mean.
Well, but that doesn't mean we can't see him ever. We could have seen the original Indian film.
Good point.
Yeah. Richard Jewell, Clint Eastwood's movie, still struggling. That's at $23 million and counting. China's not going to rescue it, but China has helped a little bit for Angel Has Fallen. The franchise opened up in that country and made another $6 million. I think it's at about $140 million worldwide. The same is true for Ford versus Ferrari. It made another $6 million this week. It's at $203 million and counting. Almost a comedy, the Chinese comedy romance, that hit $23 million. Da Bang 3, the Indian action comedy, that's at $29 million. Life is Beautiful, Roberto Benigni, his film opened up in China. I guess they need content. It made $4 million when it opened up, one of the most successful international films of all time. Certainly one of the most successful, if not the most successful Italian film of all time. It's now at $233 million worldwide.
Now, if that doesn't tell you that China needs content when they open a movie that's 20 years old.
Well, some would say it's a classic, though we both do not like it at all.
What do you mean? I liked it.
Oh, you did? Oh, well, there's nothing wrong with a reissue. So, but yes, it's telling that it would open so wide and make decent money. Right below that are two Russian films, Ivan Tsarevich and The Grey Wolf 4. and Union of Salvation. The first is an animated film, the fourth in a franchise. In that movie, I believe it's about Russian folk heroes from folk tales who have come back to life and are in modern times and looking for new adventures. In this film, from the trailer, which admittedly is in Russian, it looks like they sign up for Russian Idol. They're in a singing competition of some sort. And then Union of Salvation, that's a period drama in Russia. It's about the Decemberist Revolt, in which soldiers refused to pledge loyalty to the Tsar because the Tsar was not willing to modernize the country. And it was a huge dramatic part of the country's history in the early 1800s. If you've seen The Coast of Utopia by Tom Stoppard on stage, you've seen this dramatized from the point of view of the intellectuals. This is about the soldiers. China would not let this movie get made. So I'm wondering, do Russians see this as an allegory for today and Putin, or do they not make the connect the dots at all?
Don't ask me.
I'm asking our listeners. But tell me, Sperling, what's the worldwide box office for 2018? We know 2019 is coming in. That's at about $41.4 billion. What did it gross 1 year earlier? $41.7 billion. So it's possible, when all the numbers are added up, the worldwide box office will be down slightly for the entire world, but it's still the second highest grossing year of all time. Now, what happened in China?
Okay, well, since we did manage to get the worldwide box office in under 15 minutes, we should probably try and drag this out a little bit so our show is longer.
That's right.
And mention that China box office was actually up, okay? It was up 5% to $9.2 billion. I guess the year before was 9%.
Yeah, right? That's a big growth. So at a 5% growth rate, you can't assume they're going to leap back up again. I mean, it's possible to have a couple big hits. But if they grow at 5% a year, China will hit $11 billion a year in 2023. At that point, North American box office will probably be at least $12 billion. Some people still say, oh, China's going to pass the U.S. up in 2020. No, it's not going to happen this year. It probably won't happen for 3 or 4 years, and perhaps not even then.
Well, if you think about it, okay, Disney movies alone, okay, they grossed worldwide, okay, so that's not outside the U.S. and outside Canada and outside Mexico, $11.1 billion worldwide. They were 33% of the entire North American box office. To give you some sense as to what the next, you know, studio down, Warner Brothers had 14%, was less than half of that.
Well, 14% would be a great number if you had 5 or 6 studios and they were all making 10 or 15%. That's just not the case here. Disney, of course, at $11.1 billion would be the second biggest market. But if you throw in the Fox titles that they actually released, their total is $13.2 billion. So that corporation did, in fact, gross $13.2 billion. More than the single biggest market in the world. Not so surprising because you've got the whole world to play in. You should be making more than the North American box office if you're really, really lucky.
Well, you know, this is, you know, when we record, the real work week, the real work year is beginning this week, right?
Yeah,
you know, people
yeah.
are coming back from vacation. I wonder if like the human resources department over at Disney is going to be like crammed with people asking for raises.
Well, they asked for raises, don't they? Some details came out about what Disney demands from exhibitors. And apparently they demand 65% of grosses from exhibitors for the first 4 weeks of their big tentpole movies.
That has been the case for some time, especially with Star Wars.
That seems really, really high.
It is incredibly high, and I...
And the first 4 weeks means basically most of the box office for most movies.
Correct. And here's the worst part, you know, if you really want to call it the worst part, but here's another part. They are demanding, as part of their film rental terms, that you keep the film on the biggest screen, or at least in theaters, for 4 weeks.
Well, that's
no matter what.
What do you mean?
No matter what.
Well, that's a big change. On the biggest screen or just in a theater? I mean, those are two very different demands.
I think that they would probably bend to just in the theater, but of course they start off with, when you're negotiating, you start off with in the biggest theater.
Right.
And then, you know, you kind of see how the film does, and then you that's one of those things where if the film is really not doing well and the exhibitors start coming back at you and saying, look, we're going to have to move it over to a smaller screen.
They say fine. They can't be jerks and penalize everyone who does that when a movie is a huge flop. They do it if there's something on the bubble and they want to put a little pressure on them. But
right,
surely
exactly.
Disney is understanding, so it doesn't demand.
To some extent, but barely.
Huh. Well, can you say antitrust? I mean, you know.
I can. Can you say, hey, maybe you should keep that Paramount consent decree in a little longer? By the way, you owe me 25 cents.
What about France? What's happening in France? We're getting numbers from individual markets now. So that's good news. And I'm sure we'll be getting more and more from Germany and the UK and all that. But we've got numbers from France.
Yeah, well, you know, in a lot of countries, they you know, record box office through ticket sales. They don't necessarily say, hey. Best.
Well, they do both, but yeah.
Yeah. In France, they do both. You're right. So 213 million ticket sales. So they broke a 50-year record, and they had a total of $1.5 billion.
And if you think about it, 50 years ago was the mid-60s when France was, you know, dominating the world artistically. They were had great directors like Truffaut and Godard, and they were the talk of the town. So that's not surprising at all that that was the era when they were, you know, selling so many tickets because they were the talk. You know, everybody loved France. And if you look at the top 10, unfortunately, France is dominated by Hollywood now. Hollywood ruled with just one French film in the top 10. That was Serial Weddings 2 or Bad Weddings 2. That's that movie we've talked about a family with three daughters who marry into three different faiths. And still ask, where is the Hollywood remake? That movie seems perfect for Hollywood.
Well, you know, I think they're going to have another, maybe they'll adopt a daughter so that they can have a
fourth
another.
Faith, so they can, I mean, they've got, you know, Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, I think Islam and Hinduism, I forget what the three are. I mean, there's Judaism, there's Buddhism, Hinduism, you know, Scientology.
They
come
need
on.
More kids.
That's right. Maybe MGM will pick up that movie and make a remake of it.
Well, okay. I know that you mentioned that, you know, MGM has a new head, a new topper, a new chief. Michael DeLuca is taking over at MGM. And if that name sounds familiar, it's because for years he was the head of
New Line. That's right. And he's taking over all of MGM's film labels, including Orion and even MGM on stage. So I would be jealous about that because I'd love to have a piece of that. He's been involved with everything from The Social Network to 50 Shades of Grey and the Emmy-winning miniseries Escape at Dannemora. So he's had a good couple of years, a good quality name. He's done a lot of good movies, so we'll have to see how he does. But hopefully he will continue the diversity push that's been happening all over Hollywood. This year, some numbers are in. Again, it's the week of numbers. A record 10.8%, almost 11% of all the top grossing movies were directed by women in 2019. That's only one out of 10 films. If you're talking about the top 100 or 200 movies, you're looking at 10 or 20 films. But that's a big jump over recent years. The bad way to look at it is that number could increase 500% and it would just equal their percentage of the population. Women of color are very poorly represented. But if you look at Sundance, 35% of all films at Sundance last year were directed by women. 20% of all Netflix films were directed by women. So,
but isn't that how it starts? I mean, really, like, you know, you have to... You have to start somewhere.
Yeah.
You start like at places like Sundance, maybe at places like Netflix, and slowly over time, more and more women will.
Well, but there's no reason it should be slowly. There are women who are talented, ready to direct today. They don't need to say, well, let's, you know, slow your horses, honey. You know, you got to pay your dues. Hey, they've been paying their dues for 100 years. They used to dominate in writing and editing, and they were kicked out of those areas in Hollywood. They used to film, direct a lot more movies in the early silent era, and then they got kicked out of that. So they're well overdue for representation.
Well, do you want to hire some of those women who were directing in the silent era?
I wish I
could. And maybe they could make movies now.
I wish I could. I know that they would win awards, but they wouldn't have done it last night at the Golden Globes. Men dominated the top prizes. I think, you know,
was one of Ricky Gervais's jokes. He said it was totally unacceptable.
You are the only person who remembers Ricky Gervais's jokes.
Well, he said that, you know, I thought was kind of funny. He said he talked to the Hollywood Foreign Press about it, and he said this was unacceptable. And so that the best way to fix it is to not have women direct anything at all. And that way they wouldn't have to worry about whether women were selected in the best director category.
Yeah, it's not funny. So 1917 by Sam Mendes was the big attention getter that won Best Director and Picture, whereas Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood won Best Comedy or Musical.
It's not like you forgot the name of the film. You paused because there's a dot, dot, dot.
That's right. And Best International Film was Parasite. Best Actor, Joaquin Phoenix for Joker. Taron Egerton charmed the pants off everybody and won Best Actor for a Comedy or Musical in Rocket Man. Renee Zellweger won for Judy. Awkwafina broke down barriers by winning for The Farewell. And Brad Pitt and Laura Dern won in the Best Supporting Actor categories. I am sure every single one of those films and every single one of those actors will be nominated in their respective categories come Oscar time.
I would agree with you there, but now let me ask you this, because let's just do a quick review for those of you who don't know. The Golden Globes are handed out by the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, a group of about, let's call it 100 and give them, you know, the benefit of the doubt, 100 journalists from around the world. And they tend to like things like, I don't know, Rocket Man. They loved Rocket Man.
Well, Hollywood loves Rocket Man. It made a lot of money, made $200 million. It's a big hit. He'll be nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, absolutely. But I guess
it's an award show by people who don't vote on the Oscars, so it doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is if, like the Grammys, the best thing you can do is get on and perform. And at the Globes, you are performing. If you're a person who wins an award, you get to give a speech, and you can help yourself at the Oscars or hurt yourself if you give a boring, bad speech. So who gave the best speeches of the night?
I would say maybe Taron Egerton gave a good speech.
Because he was so adorable? He just can't help
because
it.
I don't think he thought he would actually win. I think he thought, like, look, there are, you know, some big name actors in this category.
It's the Golden Globes. Anybody can win.
Well, that's true. He actually got up. He was like, I really should have written something. I don't know that Awkwafina, I think she gave a good speech, but she was flabbergasted.
Well, that can be adorable. That can be appealing and charming that somebody genuinely seems appreciative and overwhelmed. Unlike, say, Joaquin Phoenix, who gave a sincere speech, but was sort of rambling and, like, you know, still has that vibe of don't give me an award.
Yeah, he literally, I mean, I don't know what, I was like, Joaquin, this is your moment, okay? This is the start of your campaign. I mean, granted, your campaign has already started, but this is the first, like, you've been, everything else has been a dress rehearsal. This, you're on stage now, okay? And he just rambled.
But he did not he was sincere.
Himself?
Yeah. I feel like he was sincere. You never knew what he was going to say. That's sort of fun. A tightrope like that. And while he chided people for driving, you know, riding in private jets just to go away for the weekend, it was generally, you know, a heartfelt speech.
And I thought Brad Pitt did a good job. I mean, I thought, you know, especially in his parting words, he said, look, you know, given what's going on in the world today, tomorrow, if you can be nice to someone, anyone,
wasn't it Tom Hanks who talked about being nice to people?
And, I think they both did.
Oh, well, and Ellen DeGeneres, she gave a lovely career award speech. I thought it was very sweet and cute, tributes to Carol Burnett and all the people who came before her and what she tried to do in her career. So I thought that was nice. I'll tell you one thing I heard at the Golden Globes that I do not believe, and that is Quentin Tarantino is done directing films. Yeah, right. Tell it to Soderbergh. He may direct a TV series, he may direct whatever, he may write more and let other people direct the scripts, but no way is he done directing films.
Yeah, no, look at him. Look at his speech. Look at the way he behaved on stage. Do you think he's done in this industry? I highly doubt it. Now, let me ask you this, though. Do you think he hurt himself yesterday?
Why? What did he do to hurt himself?
Well, just his speech was, you know, normally, you know, you get up and you thank a whole bunch of people, but I'm the screenwriter. I did it all myself. I've got nobody to thank. It's just me.
Is that what he said?
Yeah.
And well, that's a joke.
Yeah, but then when David Heyman, he let David Heyman, the producer, speak when they won, you know, I guess, Best Music or Comedy, and he... As David Heyman was kind of thanking him, he and saying, look, he's the maestro. He's the reason we're all here. You know, he was kind of acting like, yep, it's all me. It's all me. Like in the background, he was like, yeah, that's me. That's me.
Yeah, well, there you go. Those sort of hidden little messages or ways people read a scene can matter if they feel like he was being too big for his britches or too James Cameron a la Titanic. Then that can hurt him for sure. But one thing did not hurt his film, and that's the American Society of Cinematographers. They announced their nominees for the best shot films of the year, and all five of them will be on the Oscar list.
Yeah, so we have Ford versus Ferrari, definitely. Just the car racing alone was amazing. The Irishman, hey, it's The Irishman. It's 3.5 hours long. You had a lot of time to get good shots in there. Joker, which was really well shot. 1917, which of course has the trick of it being the one take, even though it's not one take, let's face it. And then Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's right. So those are all up for their best film of the year. We'll have to see who they pick, but those will all be on the long list for Oscar, I'm pretty confident. And then
I guess I'm going to have to actually go see The Irishman. Now, should I go see it in a movie theater?
I would. It would be hard to enjoy at home. You need to be trapped for 3 hours and 20 minutes. That's the best way to experience it at home. You will stop it. I'll finish it tomorrow. If you're going to give it any shot at all, it deserves to be seen on a big screen. I certainly didn't like it. But that's the best way to see most any film, really, but certainly The Irishman, because it's so damn long. The National Society of Film Critics named their film the best of the year is Parasite. And clearly they were spreading the love because they gave awards to everything. Antonio Banderas and Pain and Glory, Laura Dern, Brad Pitt, Greta Gerwig, Parasite, Portrait of a Lady on Fire. That was awesome. Honeyland, Best Documentary. So they spread the love for sure. But Best Picture and Best Screenplay went to Parasite. So that is a strong statement from them. Again, that film, I would strongly expect, will be one of the rare movies to make it on the shortlist for Best Picture of the Year when it's in another language. The same could happen for Pain and Glory, but it feels like that's dropped away a little bit, and Antonio Banderas is going to be the one possible, you know, breakthrough for that movie in the major categories. I'm sure both, or I hope both, will be nominated for Best International Film.
Yeah, and as far as a best nonfiction film, I'm really glad Honeyland is getting some love. That was a film that when I saw it, I thought, okay, look, you know, I'm going to watch this film because I used to keep bees, okay? Mm-hmm. I thought, oh, it's a movie about a beekeeper. It's amazing. It's an amazing feat that they made this movie. It's an amazing story.
It's depressing. It's super sad, isn't it?
Yes and no. It is super sad and yet
inspiring.
It has this hope that like pulls you through the entire film. And so in that regard, it's just such good filmmaking.
I'm just sorry I wasn't able to see it in the theater, but I hope to catch up on it soon. If I don't, it'll be a big deal because I like to see all the documentaries before the Oscars. Those are the categories, the shorts and the documentaries, where you can really help on your Oscar ballot if you're trying to win.
Well, if you think that would be a big deal, I wonder if some of the stories in Big Deal or Big Whoop you'll feel the same way about. Because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, the worldwide box office for movies hit $41 billion in 2019. Add in digital downloads and streaming, and I don't know, what is this? Blu-ray.
I was just in Target, and they do not sell Blu-ray players anymore. You can't even buy them.
You can't buy them. I mean, I was going to try.
You got to go online.
Yeah. Yeah. The total market for movies, it grows even bigger to throw all of those in. Okay. Hey, who's laughing, by the way? It's our young friends, the video game industry, of course. They're not videos anymore. We know that. Most gaming is done digitally, whether on your phone or online or via digital downloads. What's a digital download?
Keep going.
Okay. But wherever people play games, it's big, big business. The digital gaming industry hit a record $109 billion worldwide in 2019, up about 3% over 2018. And as we'll explain a little later on, that's 100 times Broadway, okay? Now, the biggest hit, you might ask, okay, so what is the biggest hit?
But now, if we look at worldwide, Broadway does have shows all over the world.
Yeah,
so you'd be looking at theater. And the same with film. If you add in all that other stuff, it gets close to $100 billion, if not equaling it. So, you know.
Well, what do you think the biggest hit game-wise was, Michael? It was, of course, TikTok. I'm kidding. It was Fortnite, which grossed $1.8 billion alone. Oh, by the way, in 2018, that same game grossed $2.4 billion. So take that, Avengers Endgame. So online games like Fortnite and Call of Duty Modern Warfare, they are big business. But the real money is in mobile gaming, which controls 75% of the market. Apparently, when you're not listening to our delightful podcast, you know, which is like two hours of the week, okay? So you only have 2 hours to do this. 2 hours to play Candy Crush Saga.
No, and you screwed up. You screwed it
Honor
up.
Honor of Kings.
You screwed
I'm trying
up
to.
The joke.
What was the joke?
Well, You did. Never mind, obviously.
Well, tell the joke then.
There's no joke. It's just you ruined the rhythm of the line. But with your improv, okay. Apparently, when you're not listening to our delightful podcast, you're playing Candy Crush Saga in honor of kings.
Okay, well, maybe that does sound funnier when you say it that way. But here's my real question. It's not about the joke. My question is all of that a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. It looks like the growth kept pace with inflation. So it's not that video games have become an even bigger thing. They set a record. They're keeping pace with inflation. It's obviously a mature market when you're grossing $109 billion worldwide. They're making a ton of money on mobile gaming. So that's a huge sea change in the industry. They've also switched from sending you discs or cartridges to having people playing digital downloads or playing online with other people around the world. So there's a lot that's changed in the industry, and they've kept pace with it. So that's good to see.
Well, okay. You can apparently shoot a film in Jordan, the country, and even get a tax break after the government looks at your script. You just can't show that film in Jordan. Is that so unusual? The latest example is a Netflix film called Messiah. It's about a modern-day prophet the CIA is investigating amidst outrageous claims called Al-Masih, which is Arabic for Messiah. The man is either a divine figure or a con artist, or maybe he's delusional, and that's the main character of the film. Some have already protested the film, even though, of course, they haven't seen it, claiming Messiah is anti-Muslim. They launched a change.org petition, which has been joined by 4,000 people. That's like basically nothing. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop all around. I would expect I could film a film in Jordan, and they wouldn't let me show it in their country because it's a very restrictive country. So that doesn't seem surprising at all. Any schmuck can launch a change.org petition. I hate when people give it, there's a pro. It's like, no. Somebody tried. It didn't work. So ignore it. The movie, haven't seen it. No idea, but this is becoming an increasing problem for Netflix. They make movies. They want to make them available all over the world. Their feeling is, hey, if you don't want to watch it, just don't watch it. That's not enough for people. They want to ban from their country, or they're angry that Netflix would make it in the first place. So that's a big problem.
They don't want it available. They don't want, they don't want it becoming popular in their country. And then kind of, it's one thing to ban it from movie theaters where you kind of, it can always have a limited audience in movie theaters. But on Netflix, anybody can watch it.
That's true. So moving on, because this is a story for you, Sperling, Coachella. So Coachella announced its 2020 lineup, and women are conspicuously missing. After headliners Lady Gaga, Ariana Grande, and of course Beyonce in the last 3 years made big waves, the Coachella names topping each night this year all have Y chromosomes. They are Travis Scott, Rage Against the Machine, and Frank Ocean, the enigmatic rapper who has signed on to Fest and then canceled at the last minute. Let's see if he shows up this time. Some thought Lana Del Rey might graduate to headliner thanks to a new album named One of the Best of the Year and Even Decade by certain critics. And others were hoping the reunited band My Chemical Romance would pop in, like me. No luck. And the final question, will Sperling show up? Hey, that's you, Sperling. Will you be at Coachella? And is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's kind of a mediocre deal. It's not a big whoop because you get Frank Ocean. Okay, will he show up? He tends to shun live performances, as you mentioned. And
are you excited by the lineup, and are you going?
Not at all.
Are you going?
I do not plan on going this year. I saw Rage Against the Machine the last time they performed live, which was in 2007 when they were at Coachella. And they tend to kind of get back together once every 10 years, apparently. I have no desire to see Travis Scott. Although there have been, I read a lot of stories about how Travis Scott and Frank Ocean and even Rage Against the Machine, very worthwhile seeing live rather than on a YouTube stream. I just have no desire to see any of these bands.
But there's like 100 acts at Coachella.
Right, and there's more than 100 acts, and of them, maybe there's 10 I would want to see. That said, well, now 10 is a lot, right? However, those are 10 that will get on stage. They'll be able to do about a half an hour to 45 minutes of their set, and then they're done. Like
aren't there lots of little tents? Aren't there multiple stages? I mean, all acts only get half an hour everywhere?
No. They get like about 45 to 50 minutes.
Uh-huh.
So like David Byrne, for instance, he was there. He did that whole American Utopia thing, right? Mm-hmm. And it was great. However, it was only 50 minutes long. And it
was one of the best things you ever saw.
I'm sorry?
You said it was one of the best concerts you've ever seen.
Yeah, that David Byrne was
as good as Beyonce's.
Yes, it was. Yeah. It was very, very good.
Well, that sounds like 50 minutes well spent.
Yes. However, would you spend $429 and have to stand
in have $429. Please send money.
Dirt at showbizsandbox.com.
Yes, God forbid you set up the donate button for 2020, Sperling.
You know, look, I'll get around to it. It'll takes me about 10
years. You were going to build my website? You can't even add a donate button.
Okay, let me ask you this. Did you find any of these acts? I mean, some of them, snail mail and things like that. I was a little surprised Hot Chip was so far down the list.
Well, people they have funny comments about, ooh, the font size went up for our band this year, you know? So, yeah, I did not really look at the list because I'm not going. It sounds like an off year to you.
It does. However, here's a couple of observations. One, I'm getting older. There are names in here that I'm like, who are these people? And I used to know most of the bands that were playing, and the ones that I didn't, I would go look up and go, oh, they're pretty good. I'm glad I heard about this Arcade Fire. Yeah, I'm glad I heard about them. And that was like way back in 2003, 2004 when they were kind of just breaking. But now I'm like, who are like 90% of these people? And
that just means you're old.
That just means, yes, as you said, I'm old. The second thing is, remember last year when people were like, oh, this is a horrible lineup. And at the very last minute, you could get tickets easily. You could easily get tickets for either the first weekend or the second weekend, because this is one of the first music festivals of the music festival season. And it takes place in April over two weekends, the same shows both weekends, the same lineups both weekends. And I bought tickets last year for the first weekend, and I could not get rid of them. I sold them, I think, at a loss, in fact. Well, this weekend, they put tickets on sale back in May of the previous year. So if you wanted tickets for the first weekend, you had to buy them in May, 11 months earlier you had to buy them. Okay, now you can't buy them at all. They're saying, oh, no, it's sold out. We sold out. That's how popular we are. We sold out that first weekend. And I have a feeling they did that. They never did that before. They would always hold tickets back so that people in January could buy tickets and not feel like they had to buy tickets before the acts were announced.
But now they need to increase demand.
That's right. So they're saying, oh, no, it's sold out. It's sold out. You can't buy tickets for the first weekend. And I think that's not necessarily for this year. They're trying to telegraph, hey, next year, if you want to go to that first weekend, you better buy them in May.
Yeah, that makes sense. They've got the second weekend, so there's, no complaining.
Right. So everybody can go to the second weekend. And let's face it, if you really want to go to the first weekend, just wait until about the month before. You can go on StubHub or Craigslist. You can always buy them there.
So even when Sperling doesn't go to Coachella, he has a lot to say. And I love to talk about public domain.
Oh, you do, actually. And I was actually going to start this show off by asking Michael whether we should, let me read about this, because the U.S. copyright law, it's rightly known as the Mickey Mouse Law. And you might ask, well, why? And it's not because Disney fights to make sure Mickey never goes into the public domain, even though they do, which, by the way, is why it's dubbed the Mickey Mouse Law. No, it's a Mickey Mouse Law because it's so goofy. It stifles creativity, hurts the arts and the public at large, and only truly benefits multinational corporations. But here's the good news. All the stuff created in the U.S. in 1924 has finally entered the public domain. Listing those works gives you the best idea possible of how absurd the current law is in practice. The popular concert piece, Rhapsody in Blue by George Gershwin, is just entering the public domain. I was going to actually start this show off, Michael, by asking you whether we should change
No, because then people would think we were sponsored by, what was it, American Airlines?
Yes, that's true, actually. I was going to see if we should, I was going to mention that, but then I realized it was in the show notes. I thought, maybe I'll just save it for Big Deal or Big Whoop. By the way, also entering the public domain, Buster Keaton's silent film, Sherlock Jr. and the Navigator, along with Harold Lloyd's Girl Shy. Novels you can now legally download for free include classics like Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, E.M. Forster's A Passage to India, and Whodunits by Agatha Christie. So Rian Johnson, you know, you can save a few bucks now. You can just, you know, adapt one of those. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, I think, in the context of things. It just shows how absurd our law is. It's the worst in the world. It doesn't help anybody. So it's long overdue for overhaul. But with these powerful big companies fighting it, it's probably not going to happen.
Now, do you know why that it's 1919? Listen to me. 20, well, it's 1924. But do you know why it was extended that 20 years?
Why specifically?
Yeah, it was Sonny Bono that actually went ahead and like wrote the bill and sponsored the bill.
Well, it's because every big major, you know, corporation that involves intellectual property wants to keep it going.
Yes. And unfortunately,
I know we always pick on Disney, but the Gershwin estate was really fighting to keep it going too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it most certainly was.
They all do.
Now, is James Corden the king of all media? Howard Stern would probably have an argument with that. He triumphed in the theater. Okay, first with The History Boys, and then starring in the hugely popular comedy, and of course, my favorite thing to say, One Man, Two Governors. Then he created and starred in the British comedy sitcom Gavin and Stacey. He's been in movies, hosted award shows, and of course, pulled off the crazy pivot of conquering America via his late-night talk show. That led to the viral sensation of Carpool Karaoke. And instead of being seen as too popular and ready for a come down, Corden remains very popular in the UK. If you need some proof, he revived Gavin and Stacey for a one-off holiday special that won the Christmas Day viewing sweepstakes over there in the UK. Every channel programs TV specials of their most popular shows each year on December 25th. And Gavin and Stacey beat all comers with 11.6 million viewers. Almost half of all viewers watching the telly when it aired on Christmas Day. He even beat out the Queen, whose Christmas speech came in at number two on the BBC. Well, on the BBC at least, with 7.8 million eyeballs. Now, does that mean that it was, hold on, 3.4? Yeah. How many people was that? Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's just a one-off special for James, but he had a good Christmas Day. But he really is triumphing in a lot of different areas, and he just keeps getting bigger. Kind of amazing. Of all the guys in the History Boys, I did not think that guy in the far left was the one that was going to, you know, others have really done terrifically well too, but good heavens, James, good for you.
Now, I see that you've included a story, and I actually went to include this story and then decided, I'm not going to include it. And then I realized, oh, it's already in there. And that is that Universal Music Group, you know, the big music company, they sold a 10% stake in themselves, in their company, to China's Tencent for $3.4 billion.
I think China's Tencent has it in their contracts that all deals must be for 10%. You know, they're like, we'll buy 10% of UMG, and they have an option to buy another 10%. They could have bought 20% at once, but like, no, we like to do it at 10%, you know. So
10% at a time.
That's so people remember us. So if they would like to invest in a podcast and want 10% of Showbiz Sandbox, call us.
Yes, and we will be a lot cheaper than $3.4 billion.
Not that much cheaper. So the stake that they secured 10% was in fact $3.4 billion that values Universal Music Group at $34 billion. And they want to sell off a non-controlling 50% of the company to raise money and do whatever. I'm not quite sure why, but that's their goal. And one of the intimations was that they sold this chunk to China because they want to scare other people into thinking China's going to take them over and they better buy some of it, which is a bizarre way of surely they just sold it to China because China was a willing buyer and they had the money and they were happy to make a deal with them, not to try and trick other people into saying, oh, we better step it up and worry about China owning a piece of our company. You know, just a
No, I mean, I think they also, it helps if you want to enter the Chinese market to actually say, look, we have Chinese investors.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, China will probably have 20% of UMG when all is said and done. So, I think it's just a state of things. People used to panic over Saudi Arabia investing in American companies. Then they panicked over Japan buying in American real estate and companies. Now they panic over Chinese companies. It's just the way of the world.
Well, Michael, I'll speak for both of us in saying that we will not panic if anybody invests in us.
Not at all.
No, but that does wrap up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. Now, here's how this affects you this week. Broadway, it had a disastrous year at the box office, okay? It's down a whopping 3% from 2018. Okay, that's really only $67 million less, or about the cost of what, like two Hamilton tickets, actually. The Great White Way grossed $1.7 billion, or, as Marvel likes to say, one Avengers movie. And now that you mention it, that's the second highest grossing season of all time. So what are people complaining about?
Oh, and by the way, last year may have grossed a little bit more, but it had more playing dates because of the way the calendar worked. It had an extra week or something. So there's that. So, you know, maybe 2019 was, in fact, if you average it out, the greatest year in theater history after all. And they did set a record. This season, Broadway sold more tickets than any other season in modern history. Everything I read said in history, period, but I'm just not so sure about the 20s and 30s when you had, you know, hundreds of shows appearing on Broadway. But in all, 90% of every available seat was sold, which means this show may be down and that show may be up and Hamilton may be here and Harry Potter may be there. But overall, Broadway is a huge draw. To be exact, 14.6 million tickets were sold. So they have an inventory of tickets. You know, imagine every seat for every performance, usually 8 shows a week, all year long, is available for sale. And they sold 90% of them. That means there was probably like 16 million tickets available in all for Broadway. Imagine if movie theaters sold 90% of all the inventory they had. Does that happen, Sperling? No, it does not.
No. It's usually 15% is the occupancy rate.
Really? Wow. Yeah. Thank you, Cats.
well. By the way, it's 15% of all shows.
All tickets to all shows. Yeah. So Friday night is 8 is full, and Tuesday right. at noon is not. Yeah, correct. We get it nonetheless. Now, Broadway did it. Matinees, evening, didn't matter. They only have 8 shows a week rather than 8 shows a day for every movie. But still, that's very impressive. Clearly, they are delivering product that people want to see.
But now let me kind of bring this back to our audience for a second, because a lot of people I know and I hear this from our listeners.
I don't know why they keep saying it. You've explained yourself. Broadway shows are seen all over the world.
But, you know, if somebody is listening,
there are
shows from
India and Japan and Korea. There's a Korean remake of Titanic I'm looking forward to see. There are British shows that come to America and tour the world. There are Australian shows that tour the world. Canadian shows just dominated on Broadway. Wherever you live, wherever you are, France, Germany, Spain, there are shows that break out and become hits all over the world, and that's why we talk about theater.
Right. Now, let me just, this is where I was headed with this.
You're always headed somewhere, aren't you?
Yeah, I'm trying. I'm always trying to head somewhere. So over the last 10 years, attendance is up 20% on Broadway. Good thing, right?
Yeah.
Good thing. Yeah, ticket prices are up 70%. Thank you, Hamilton. So that said, you know, as you know, Michael, and we talk about it a lot, it's very difficult for a show to make money, especially plays. And there are plays being made where the producers know they're not going to make money on Broadway. They're not actually even trying to make money on Broadway. What they're really trying to do is get that Broadway cred.
Brand.
So that they can, so that they can go to Australia, or maybe not this week, but Australia, Japan, France, England, Germany, and take a show like, maybe not Slave Play, but a show like Wicked, for instance. And I realize that's, 15
Wicked,
years
that's
old.
A monster hit.
Yeah, and take it overseas. Okay, that was a hit, so maybe
example. Slave Play is a good example of a show where they're really taking a gamble, but they feel long-term that the gamble of taking it to Broadway builds the career of the playwright, builds the brand of the show so that a challenging work like that can be seen and tour the country and maybe break out overseas. But nobody rarely puts a show on Broadway as a loss leader. Nobody says that let's take it to Broadway because we think we're going to lose money, but we know long-term it will pay off. I think the one recent example of that might be Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. There was a musical version of Percy Jackson. It was a show made on the cheap, really for kids, but it got nice reviews and they brought it to Broadway, even though it got lambasted by critics, because they knew they could then say, hey, this is a Broadway show. The show played on Broadway. The Broadway hit, Percy Jackson. It did terrible. Their transfer probably lost the money, but it was made for pennies, put on for pennies with a no-name cast. Sorry, guys, you're all talented. But that is as close to a loss leader as I can think of from last season. Everything else, they hope to make money.
Can I tell you a little personal story about that Percy Jackson musical?
Sure.
So there I was with my kids in New York City, and they had come to see Hamilton. Okay, I wasn't going to see it again because, you know, again, the millions of dollars it requires to see that show. And we're staying in the Village somewhere, and we're walking around, and oh my gosh, there's a theater in the middle of some block. I think it was like West 10th Street, like over by like 9th Avenue or something. There's a theater, and it's showing this musical, Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief. And they're like, oh, we got to see. I said, okay, fine, let's go see it. So, you know, we went and saw that when it was like off Broadway. Now, you said you saw Knives Out, correct?
Yes.
And there was a kind of a quick inside joke there where Don Johnson, who's in the movie, asks, hey, did you see Hamilton? And he says, I saw it when it was in the public.
Right.
I saw it before it was a hit.
That's right. Well, it was a hit at the public.
I said, right, I know. But I saw Lightning, Percy, whatever, when it was so far off, but before anybody even knew about it. That's how in the know I am.
Exactly. And that brings us to the New York Music Festival, which is a great venue for showcasing new musicals. It's been around in New York for 15 years. I loved it. I went many years and saw as many shows as I could. It spawned big hits like the Pulitzer Prize winner You're in Town, also Title of Show, which went to Broadway and had a lot of acclaim and launched careers for people. It was just a great incubator for new musicals and talent, and unfortunately, it just collapsed amidst financing troubles. Apparently, the staff has been working for free since August. Then they realized none of the artists who had performed in the previous year, who brought their shows to Nymph, they do it at a loss, talking about a loss. They spend money to bring it, and they get a little bit money back from ticket sales. They get a percentage. None of it makes them in the black, but it does help defray the cost of the shows. Well, the staff working at Nymph found out nobody had been paid yet for 2019. And so when they realized, okay, we're not getting paid, the artists who bring their shows here and, you know, sacrifice so much to come here and get the showcase of New York, they're not getting paid. So the staff resigned en masse in January. The gig was up. Everybody realized they had six figures of debt. And sadly, the New York Music Festival has collapsed. So that's really a shame because it was a great, great festival, did great work. I was hoping, like, you know, the Fringe Fest in the UK, that this might catch on and be around for decades to come. I had no idea they were in trouble. So that's a shame.
Well, now it's time to play one of our favorite games, invest or not invest. And we're going to try and go through this quickly because we have a lot of shows to go through. But this is where Michael Giltz, you know, you do a lot of theater coverage.
That's right.
So my question and our question is whether you would invest in any of these upcoming shows or whether you wouldn't invest in these, because of course sometimes they don't make money. A lot of times these productions don't make money. Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go through some of these. The first up is I Am Lucy Barton. It's a one-woman show based on Alice McDermott, or at least an Alice McDermott novel, and it stars Laura Linney. Invest or not invest?
Well, it played the UK and got good reviews. It's a limited run, but it's just one person on the stage talking. I've heard the book. I didn't read it, but I heard it. I'm going to invest because I think it's a safe bet. I think it's a really, you know, it's a low upside, but it's a low downside as well.
Okay. Well, what about A Soldier's Play? It's a revival of the Pulitzer Prize winner starring David Alan Grier and Blair Underwood.
Well, my feeling was that A Soldier's Play might not stand up after time has passed, probably just because I saw the film and didn't think that was that great. But it's a very starry cast. David Alan Grier has been nominated for Tonys three times. Blair Underwood from L.A. Law. I'm kind of intrigued, and it is a limited run because all these people have other obligations. But you know what? I've changed my mind, and I feel like this might be worth taking a chance on.
Now, this next one, can we just skip because I know what the answer is? It's
no, you don't.
West Side Story.
But it's directed by Ivo Van Hove, and that guy is a crapshoot. And my feeling was, no, I do not want to invest in West Side Story. He's cut somewhere. He's cut. You know, the show is 90 minutes long, no intermission. It's tough and it's real. Like, wait. It's West Side Story. You got to do somewhere at the end.
Wait. He cut the intermission?
He cut the intermission and he cut the big final song somewhere. There's a place for us. That song. But
somewhere
apparently
they may
have put it back. And they still have the intermission, but it's quick, it's sharp, it moves fast, and it's doing so good in previews. It's too late, but I would have said no, and then I would have regretted it. The last time it was on Broadway, they lost money. So West Side Story is no slam dunk, But this time people are talking and they want to see it.
Well, I got to tell you, you know, I always thought West Side Story was just too long. Grand Horizons, a new play about a wife asking for divorce after 50 years. It stars Jane Alexander and James Cromwell. It's written by Bess Wohl. Also, it stars Ben McKenzie and Michael Urey, I guess. So are you going to invest or not invest?
What do you mean guess? You guess. Ben McKenzie is a great get for Broadway. Michael Urey is one of the best actors around, and he's had a lot of success. He was on Ugly Betty, of course. And my feeling is no. It's just safe to say no, but I'm intrigued. I'd like to see it, just to see those two young guys as support. I assume they're the kids.
What do you mean? You assume they're the kids?
They're the sons of Jane Alexander and James Cromwell. I assume they're their children. Mom, dad, what are you doing? You're divorcing? That's crazy. I think that's their role, but I'd still like to see the show. But no, I will not invest.
Okay, well, what about Girl from the North Country? Get this. Connor McPherson and Bob Dylan with Mare Winningham.
Well, Mare Winningham stars. The songs of Bob Dylan were turned into a play by Connor McPherson. It played in London. It played at the Public. Now they're bringing it to Broadway. I have not seen it, but from everything I've heard, you say, really? You're bringing it to Broadway? Are you sure? It doesn't seem like a good idea.
So not invest.
Not invest, and I love Dylan.
Okay, so what about Six? It's a nutty UK musical about the wives and lovers of... Guess what?
Henry the Eighth. Oh, I'm Henry the Eighth. I remember all his wives. He killed them. Yes. He divorced them. This is very trashy. It's like the Kim Kardashian of musicals. It looks very British. You know, it's one of those wild cards that could work. It probably wouldn't cost a lot to invest in because it doesn't look like it cost a lot of money to put on. I might take a gamble if I could invest in five or six shows. I might place my money on it. But if I just had to do one, it certainly would not be Six.
What about The Minutes, a new play by Tracy Letts? It's about a small town city council. It's got a big cast with Blair Brown, Armie Hammer, Tracy Letts, Austin Pendleton, and Jesse Mueller. Invest or not invest?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Tracy Letts, and it's a big cast that's going to have other things to do, so they're going to move on. So I am saying not invest.
What about Hangman? It's a new Martin McDonagh play starring Mark Addy as Hangman, looking for what to do after executions are ended.
Yes,
this sounds like a great play, by the way.
Take up coding. That's my advice to you, Mr. Hangman. This is a play that you wanted to invest in at the beginning. You know, it's a new Martin McDonagh play. It's a good gamble. If you were in there at the beginning with the UK, so you got a piece of US and worldwide rights, then yes. If you're just investing in the Broadway production, no. But that's sort of inside baseball in terms of what you can actually have access to. Sometimes they say, okay, our show's coming to town. You get to invest in this, not the touring, not the worldwide, just this particular production on Broadway. That's more of a gamble, though Martin McDonagh is a terrific playwright. If I could do all of it and I was there at the beginning, absolutely. Martin McDonagh is a playwright worth taking a chance on every single time, and this show has gotten great reviews.
Company. That's right. It's a female spin on the Stephen Sondheim classic. It stars Patti LuPone, Katrina Lenk, and Matt Doyle. You can't afford to invest in this.
Well, you know, Stephen Sondheim shows are not huge big hits first time out. I don't know if Company has had a hit production on Broadway. This one certainly could and should be it. Great reviews from the UK. I would definitely invest.
Diana, the musical. Writers of Tony Winter Memphis, director of Come From Away, Judy Kaye as the queen, who plays Princess Diana.
I forget her name. She's a newcomer to me. I apologize if she's had a big career. Sperling, just you tell me, would you invest in Diana, the Princess of Wales, a musical about Diana?
No.
Absolutely not. Yes. I mean, if you heard the songs and could see the whole thing, we're going to go, wow, I didn't expect this to be thoughtful, subtle, and great, but I'm sure it's trashy as trashy can be.
Kind of like Mrs. Doubtfire, the musical. It stars Rob McCure of Chaplin and Beetlejuice, the musical. So what do you think?
I don't like the movie. I don't want to see the show. I think Rob McClure lacks charisma as a star. Sorry, Mr. McClure. You were fine in Chaplin. You were fine in Beetlejuice. No, no, no.
Caroline or Change with Sharon D. Clarke in a Tony Kushner, Jeanine Tesori musical.
Right,
Tony Kushner, not known for writing musicals, FYI.
Well, this was a Pulitzer Prize winner. This is a revival, of course, Caroline or Change. The original one had a lot of acclaim and did not make money. Is it going to be like Sondheim and find his shows get their audience the second time around? I don't think so. I don't think this is going to hold up well at all. It's a fine book, but there's not a single good song in the show that makes you want to, you know, as what's his name would say, who just died last week. You don't want to hum him, do you? Who just died? Mame. Hello, Dolly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Jerry.
Herman. Jerry Herman.
Yeah.
Sorry, Mr. Well, Herman. Yeah, I'm not excited by Carolina Change. I saw it when it originally came out. Tanya Perkins starred in it. She gave a great performance. That was the only reason to see the show. Maybe Sharon D. Clarke will do the same, but it won't turn this into a good musical or one worth seeing.
Well, this next show is a revival, and it's just a dreadful Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, starring Laurie Metcalf, Rupert Everett, and Russell Tovey.
I love Russell Tovey. I'm a huge fan of Rupert Everett. Laurie Metcalf is a terrific stage actor. You can't lose with Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf. It's successful, at least critically, almost every single time it's put on Broadway. It's one of my favorite shows of all time. I would absolutely invest in it. You can't, if you tell me Virginia Woolf, I'm like, where do I put the money? Let me write the check. Can I write it now, please? And Rupert Everett is a late substitution. I forget for whom, but I'm excited to see him back on Broadway.
Well, I would invest in staying at the Plaza, but would you invest in Plaza Suite, a revival with Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker?
Yeah, it's the Neil Simon play, and the play is probably dated and may not hold up, but who knows? Maybe we'll be surprised, like Boing Boing, the sort of goofy comedy that was revived with Mark Rylance and was sensational. But all I know is it's Matthew Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker on the stage together. I would absolutely invest.
American Buffalo, another revival, this one by David Mamet. It's going to star Lawrence Fishburne, Sam Rockwell, and Darren Criss.
Again, this is a limited run, just like a number of the other shows, like a Soldier's Play and some of these shows with big starry cast. So you're really talking about just, do you think the show's worth seeing? Because it's not going to run for 2 years. And if it does, you'll have to swap out other people. American Buffalo is long overdue. It's been a while since Mamet has had a good show on Broadway that's been a good new play or a good revival that's been well done. Maybe this one will do the trick. Lawrence Fishburne on stage and Darren Criss, I'm intrigued. I would like to see it, and I feel like it's not going to cost a lot, so I'm willing to invest.
Flying Over Sunset, a musical by Tom Kitt, next to normal, by the way, and Michael Corey, Grey Gardens, and written and directed by James Lapine. Dropping Acid with Cary Grant, playwright Claire Booth Luce, writer Aldous. What is going on here?
Tony Yazbek plays Cary Grant. This is a nutty show with a nutty premise. It's about all these people being together and dropping acid. Dear God, no, I would not invest in it, but I sure want to see in it. You know, again, you're talking about looking at it from outside. If you can go to the presentation, of course, that changes everything. But just looking at it on paper, Flying Over Sunset, it looks like a big roll of the dice from Lincoln Center. But James Lapine's a great talent. It's a weird, nutty story, but I am not ready to put money down.
Birthday Candles. Deborah Messing is going to play. It's going to be in a play about a woman's birthdays ranging from 17. I don't think Deborah Messing can play 17.
Yes, she can.
Maybe she can play.
Broadway is theater. Of course she can.
Well, maybe she can play 101 because it's her birthdays from all those years.
That's right. So it's a woman's birthdays throughout her life. You know, not every single one, obviously, or we'd get exhausted. But I would absolutely invest in this. First of all, it's just a new show, and it sounds like catnip for an actress of a certain age or an actress who can just play this juicy, nutty role and get to play this character throughout all these years. It sounds like the sort of thing that will play in community theater and rep. And touring for years and years to come. Again, you never know the quality, but this is this type of show that can be done inexpensively, appeals to actresses who are always looking for good roles, and looks like it could be easily staged all over the place. So I'm really excited to take a gamble on this one and see how it pans out.
How I Learned to Drive. It's a revival with the original stars, Mary Louise Parker and David Morse.
I mean, it's bizarre. They said, hey, let's bring back How I Learned to Drive. And hey, let's use the same people. Talking about Deborah Messing playing a 17-year-old, Mary Louise Parker, some 20 years later, will be playing the same character, a young girl, a teenager, who is molested by this man. It's a great play, great reviews when it was there off Broadway. I would have loved to see them in the original production, and I never did. I saw a revival, but it wasn't them. It's the first time for this show on Broadway. It's a limited run again, but with those two in it, I would love to take a gamble.
Take Me Out, a revival of the gay baseball play with Jesse Williams and Jesse Tyler Ferguson.
I saw this when it came out on Broadway. Gay player modeled a little bit on Derek Jeter, who is not gay, but is a multiracial, wildly appealing player. And that's who this guy was, who also happened to be gay. So that was the driving interest in that play. It got great reviews, had a pretty good run. I think it was overpraised at the time. I don't think it's going to hold up that well. I think the buzz is way, way gone for the show. So just like Carolina Change, I do not think this one is going to work on a second viewing.
You know, it makes me feel old that I saw this play.
Why does it make you feel old?
I don't know. It just makes me feel
Well, you're so old, someday you're going to die. And that's what's happened to some other people. It's time for the obituaries. The NBA commissioner, David Stern, died at 77. And I thought, well, that's not really, you know, our purview. But as our in-house film critic, Aaron Ritz, said, hey, you know, not for nothing, but he turned American basketball into the most successful American sport around the world. It's far bigger than football or baseball. It is a huge property, and David Stern is really responsible for that. And he saw, when he came in on board, like in 1984, the same year Michael Jordan hit the pros, he saw football and baseball fighting endless fights with their players over demands for more power, more money, and union rights and all that sort of stuff. They went to full-on war, and he said, no, our players are the stars. They're bigger than the game itself, even. He did marketing. He did video games. He saw the Olympic Dream Team, where the best American players went to the Olympics. In 1984, when he started, the average salary for a player was $250,000. Now it's $9 million. It really has a global reach. Basketball is televised in 200 countries and really beloved. It's huge in China. You know, that's why we have all that kerfuffle with China over basketball and what they're going to show and not show because of comments certain players make. He embraced the rising stars of the NBA like Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and of course, Michael Jordan. And he is a reason, the sole reason, the big reason, basketball is the biggest U.S. sport worldwide. So David Stern is an important player, and a lot of people die every week. We don't have time always to cover all of them. That's happening this week. Author MC Beaton died. She was the queen of the cozies, though she would punch you if you called her that. Jack Sheldon of Schoolhouse Rock, a trumpeter, a great musician. He did the vocals for I'm Just a Bill and Conjunction Junction. He had a great, interesting career, but that's why we remember him. Sonny Mehta of Knopf died, the big publisher. He's a huge giant in the publishing industry. Bizarrely, the New York Times said the secret to his success was that Sonny Mehta was a voracious reader. Really?
As a publisher, yeah. He's a voracious reader.
I mean, that's insane. That's exactly what they said. This guy called a visual futurist, that's what he dubbed himself, Sid Mead. He died at 86, and he worked on Blade Runner, Star Trek, Aliens, 2010, Tron. Very cool, interesting guy who sort of cut his own path. And Sperling had a very cool story in our show notes about the closing of Modern Props, a prop business headed by John Zabrucki, which has been around for 42 years. He's done a lot of cool stuff. You name it. Communicators for Star Trek II, a machine for Blade Runner, just like Sid Mead, a chair for RoboCop that recharged the RoboCop. He worked with the band Devo. Cool guy who did great stuff. Museums hopefully will snap up his warehouse of props.
Where is the Academy Museum when you need it?
Ah, jerks. All right.
No, you know what? I will say this. If you were making a sci-fi film in the U.S., your first stop was Modern Props.
Absolutely.
Because they had everything, any kind of future thing. And
you know what? He built them. He created them for you. He didn't just like have stuff lying around that said, here, you can use this. He built and created a lot of stuff. And he had this one machine in particular that he created for The Incredible Hulk that was then used by Star Trek The Next Generation, Austin Powers, and more than 100 movies and TV shows. In fact, we have a link to a YouTube video by a fan who calls it the most important device in the universe because it's in all these movies and TV shows. Kind of funny.
Yeah. Now, I mean, look, we are not giving any of these people their due, from Sonny Mehta, who, let's face it, I mean, look, he did everything from Jurassic Park to Kazuo Ishiguro. I mean, Gunter Grass, you name it. The guy was, a legend. So was Sid Mead. Blade Runner, Tron, come on. This guy was a great production designer. But you know what? We're running out of time. So That said, we will tell you this. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can rate and review the show in any one of those podcast aggregators. It does help us out when you do that. It helps other people find the show when you rate and review it. You know what? You can find those ways to subscribe to us on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. You can email us at dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. Facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can find our page. Now, all of that information, again, on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT, not George Gershwin. Now, MGMT has their own website. It is whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz can be found online at every week, he's got something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week, it's conjunctionjunction.com.
And you should definitely go back to Schoolhouse Rock for that one. If you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. In the meantime, some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
'Sing, I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill, and I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Hey, don't yank me off stage.